Chapter 10, Race History. The racial question is the key to world history. All is race. There is no other truth. That was spoken by Benjamin Disraeli. Science moves inexorably toward the truth of race. Race is simply genetics, is applied to the breeds of mankind, and it speaks to us in blood types and genotypes, in physical traits and mental abilities, in behavior and temperament, in human achievement and human failure. It tells us more about human life than cultural characteristics do, because it's the engine that makes our cultures what they are. Culture is simply a veneer reflecting the deeper genetic makeup of people. Race bequeaths diversity to this planet that affects all aspects of life. As the voices of science become more articulate on race, history and social studies speak to us just as powerfully on the subject. Recently, a distraught friend called me and told me how Jimmy, his first grader, had come home from school to tell his father that he learned where civilization came from. The 7-year-old boy led his father to his lighted globe and immediately pointed to the heart of the African continent. He proudly announced, "That's where black people and the first civilizations came from." Stunned by his answer, my friend asked his child, "Jimmy, can you tell me where white people came from?" "I don't know," said the little blue-eyed boy. The ultimate determinant of fitness for civilization is not IQ tests or psychological studies, but the straightforward barometer of performance. Even back in the time of my initial race awakening, there was some laughed-at babble about great black civilizations. Obscure Afrocentrist claims looked upon as ludicrous in the 1960s are now frequently taught in public schools. Afrocentrism, or the idea that civilization originated in black Africa, thrives, although there's not a shred of evidence that even a single black-created civilization ever developed in sub-Saharan Africa. Even ancient Egypt is being claimed as a black civilization, despite the fact that the oldest Egyptian mummies found are distinctly Caucasian and are classed as such by innumerable anthropologists and archaeologists. Any modern medical investigator competent to racially identify badly decomposed human remains would quickly classify the Egyptians as white. Even the fact that prominent-nosed, fair-skinned, and straight-haired whites are subjects of the art and the hieroglyphics of the Egyptian tombs has not deterred egalitarians from desperately clinging to fantasies that ancient Egypt was an example of black historic achievement. They have even gone so far as to depict Queen Cleopatra, who was wholly of Greek lineage, the last of the Ptolemies, who ruled from 330 to 30 BC, as an Afro-wearing black woman. Some of the purveyors of black history solemnly allege that the Greeks stole philosophy and civilization from Africa. One would be hard-pressed to understand how one steals civilization. If a nation copies another's inventiveness or ideas, does that stop the originator from using it? And if a people are gifted enough to create a great civilization, art, philosophy, and mathematics, what keeps them from continuing to replenish the fountainhead of human accomplishment? The inescapable fact is that black Africa has neither created nor even been able to sustain a high civilization. One of the most respected historians of the 20th century, Arnold Toynbee, listed what he calls 33 historic civilizations. Most are European, some are Asian, but none are black. Poor black historical performance correlates with the evidence of marked differences in intelligence between blacks and whites. In America, school children are taught endlessly about the great achievements of black Americans. With a straight face, teachers recount the most important black contributions to the modern world and then give examples such as the traffic light and the paper bag. The very fact that these things are listed as great black achievements betrays their paucity. No black is found in Michael Hart's The Hundred, the ranking of the most influential persons in history. Perhaps even more telling is there's not even one black achievement found in Isaac Asimov's listing of 1,500 great attainments in his Chronicle of Science and Discovery. Far from being a racist, Asimov publicly expresses a belief in racial equality and describes himself as a liberal. Can the invention of the traffic light or the paper bag remotely compare to the development of the Pythagorean theorem, the invention of the first airplane or the first steam engine, the engineering of the pyramids, the architecture of the Parthenon or the Roman aqueducts, the invention of the printing press, the development of the smallpox vaccine, the creation of genetic engineering, the invention of the transistor, or the mathematics and genius that took men to the moon? Such comparisons surely do not demonstrate racial equality. Instead, they suggest a disparity that goes far beyond the differences in intelligence indicated by mere IQ tests. It must be remembered that almost all the great achievements of mankind were the products of the most intelligent 4 or 5% of the population. As the bell curve and every other IQ study have shown, if one group has an average IQ about 15% lower than another, it does not mean that the lower group will have 15% fewer geniuses than the smarter group. The percentage of geniuses will differ by a rate more than 44 to 1 in favor of the more intelligent group. Some researchers say it is closer to 100 to 1, depending on how high the genius IQ level is set. The standard response of racial egalitarians to the fact that blacks account for only a small percentage of great achievements is that black societies were not advanced enough or because their societies were oppressed. Of course, such an argument is only begging the question. For what could have caused this lack of achievement for habitual oppression over thousands of years? If the capabilities for what we call civilization are the same among races, why did blacks not develop even one? In all of black Africa below the Sahara, they never developed any writing and never used the wheel. There is only one vibrant nation in Africa, the Republic of South Africa, a nation now plunging toward the same fate of the rest of black Africa with the ongoing removal of white leadership and skills. Whites dominated investment, government, education, medicine, training, and communication in Africa for 200 years. But in the 40 years since the departure of Europeans, almost every black African nation has steadily declined in its income, education, healthcare, sanitation, civil rights, and other societal levels. The disintegration in some nations, such as Sudan and Zaire, has been slowed only by the fact that once they have fallen to such low levels, there is simply little room for further decline. In their utter despair, the struggling remnants in many African nations have actually invited Europeans back, and the increased Western investment and aid should improve, even if only marginally, the current appalling conditions. Africa's social disaster cannot be blamed on lack of resources. The continent is the greatest source of untapped resources in the world. In an age where many first world nations have exhausted their resources, Africa has an excellent opportunity, which it has squandered. From the early 1970s to the 1990s, black Africa's share of world trade has fallen 50%. Its gross national product has declined about 2% per year. Food production has declined almost 20%. Malnutrition has increased, genocidal warfare has increased, AIDS is pandemic, and the continent has even less a semblance of democracy than it had just 25 years ago. Skyscrapers built and once maintained by Europeans in Nigeria now have intermittent electricity and toilets that overflow. Sanitation, hospitals, power generation, and telephone services all depend on foreign financial aid, and imported Europeans must keep them running even at the most minimal levels. European colonialists who once curbed the bloody tribal warfare were no longer present to stop the Hutus and the Tutus from murdering between 600,000 and 1 million people in Zaire. European colonists who outlawed slavery in Africa over 100 years ago are no longer present in great enough numbers to stop the enslavement of tens of thousands of Africa today. Slavery is technically outlawed in every country of the world, but in Africa it is still widespread. It is present to a degree in almost every African nation. Sudan, Ghana, Mauritania, in particular, are acknowledged as the world leaders in the slave trade. In the Nuba Mountains of Sudan alone, 30,000 African children were sold into slavery in the mid-1990s for the price of 2 chickens each. Racial egalitarians blame Europeans and white racism for the African disaster. Some have argued that the Europeans did not adequately prepare Africa for independence. Yet, while the decolonization went on, some European nations adamantly maintained that more time was needed to develop the African nations before their independence. Such claims were dismissed by white liberals in the West and by African tin-pot revolutionaries as racist and patronizing. Of course, the very idea of a need for preparation for independence begs the question, for who prepared the European nations for their independence? Of course, egalitarians always have an excuse for black historical failure. The latest apologia for the lack of African culture argues that climatic and ecological factors facilitated development of civilization in Eurasia, but prevented it in Africa. Jared Diamond, though, does not answer the question of why successful colonization by the Arabs preserved civilized qualities for centuries until the colonist race was subsumed by the native black population, and why the spark of civilization in Africa only burned when the European was there to sustain it. The next section is race and nation. When the race is good, so is the place, as said Ralph Waldo Emerson. As I became more aware of the profound biological differences between the races and better understood the impact of these differences in education, crime, poverty, and other societal issues, I began to read about the historical realities of race and culture. If racial composition can have a great impact on a school, how much does it have on a nation? Can race be instructive about the development and conditions of nations? One of my friends in high school, George Cardella, came from Colombia. He spoke to me at length about the conditions of his own and other South American lands. Often his revelations of the low living standards and crude human values startled me. He was conscious of his light blue eyes and European Spanish ancestry and talked frankly about the racial realities of his and other South American nations. In geography class, my teacher pointed out that South America has more potential geographic development than North America. It is larger in temperate land area, richer in resources, more varied in climate and topography, and had quite a head start, being intensely settled and exploited earlier than North America. The question naturally arises, why then are the countries south of the Rio Grande usually so much poorer, more unhealthy, less educated, and less free than those in the United States and Canada? South America had substantial settlements and in some places even universities before the rudimentary outposts at Jamestown and Plymouth. Spain and Portugal, nations with a rich European cultural heritage, settled the region. The modern-day discovery of America by Christopher Columbus occurred the same year as the victory over the Moors, finally expelling them from all of Spain after a struggle lasting hundreds of years. The Spanish conquistadors were fit and fearless, forged by the crucible of war and a fight for freedom that spanned generations. Suddenly, the national unity and purpose born of the victorious war with the Moors shifted to conquering and civilizing a new land and a new world. It wasn't long until the auburn-haired, green-eyed Isabella ruled Spanish possessions larger than the size of all of Europe. The Spanish and Portuguese ruthlessly exploited the native population of the Americas, and those aboriginals they did not kill in war, disease often dispatched. The discovery of precious metals such as gold and silver and the vast tracts of land then in possession of the Spanish throne encouraged the Spanish to integrate with and use the native population to develop the resources. Spanish rulers were spread thin in the immense empire, a tiny minority in a sea of color. Because the physical and psychological character of the Indians adapted poorly to servitude in some regions, to satisfy their need for laborers, they imported black slaves from Africa. Whether conquistador or priest, their primary task was exploitive in nature. The conquistador to cultivate the land's riches, the priest to harvest the inhabitants' souls. Living in a land with few white women and ample Indian maidens and black slave women, mixed liaisons and marriages were common, although such unions were looked down upon by the more aristocratic classes who often sent their sons and daughters home to Spain to find a husband or wife. The Spanish built Mexico and their other colonies throughout the Caribbean, Central and South America in their own image. They established schools, government buildings, and churches, and carried the art, technology, and culture of European civilization to the New World. In addition to Spain and Portugal, Great Britain, France, and Holland also had colonies and possessions in the Western Hemisphere. In the vast expanse, only 13 American colonies in Canada had white majorities. In North America, where there was a presence of non-whites, whether slave or free, social intercourse among the Europeans was exclusively white. In North America, Europeans came over by the hundreds of thousands, bringing their families with them, and the farming lifestyle made large families desirable, causing little shortage of women, except at the very edges of the frontier. Thus, America and Canada became overwhelmingly white nations, while the Caribbean, Central, and South Americas remained mostly non-white, except for a veneer of white leadership and control. It seemed obvious to me that the overwhelming difference between the Canadian and American colonies and the rest of the Americas was simply that of race. I discussed some of these facts with my geography teacher in high school, Mrs. Weir. She was a dyed-in-the-wool egalitarian who blustered that there were other factors that I failed to consider in my hypothesis. Her first counterargument was that North America was mostly Protestant and thus driven by the work ethic intrinsic to that denomination. My retort to that was easy. The Renaissance of Western civilization itself began in northern Italy, an exclusively Catholic society. And Quebec, a North American city, was not Protestant but had living standards far more similar to Protestant America than Mexico or Brazil. Next, she tried to argue that it was simply the democratic traditions of North America compared to the autocratic ones of South America that gave and made such pronounced differences. I pointed out that history is full of examples of both tyrannies that had become democratic and democracies that had lost their freedoms. The aristocracies of Europe certainly became great and modern nations. Many of the governing constitutions of the Middle and Southern Hemisphere nations were modeled directly after our own United States Constitution, but those instruments of law did not save them from poverty, massive corruption, tyranny and assassination, continuous revolution, illiteracy, disease, and primitive lifestyles and conditions. I ask her, when one considers that there are dozens of nations in the Caribbean and the Americas, and that there have been hundreds of revolutions and marked political changes over the centuries, are we supposed to believe that none of them ever got it right? In response to her silence, I blurted out, perhaps the thing that really makes or breaks a nation is not its institutions, but the race of its people. The race factor is seen in the differences that exist among many different nations of the Americas. Costa Rica is readily acknowledged as the most advanced nation in Central America, It has a reputation as the least corrupt government and as the one having the highest living standard and literacy rate of the region. It also prides itself on being the whitest nation of Central America. Consider the fact that the most advanced nations of South America are Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile, the nations with the continent's highest percentages of Europeans. Racial impact can also be seen within nations themselves. Brazil, for instance, is much like two different nations